Cascading gravity. And some of you may have heard about this before, but I'll basically spend the first half of my time probably just introducing the idea of what this is about. This is something of a pet project for PI. It was based on some work with by Justin Corey, Stefan Hoffman, and Geert Vali on the idea of degravitation. And it was supposed, and the attempt, what cascading gravity is, one motivation for it is an explicit realization of this idea of degravitation, and I'll get to what that is in a second. And the setup itself was developed by myself, Claudia Durand, Justin, Stefan, Gia, Michele Reddy, and Oriol Piolas, which was basically at the time a PI NYU collaboration. And with the work on this is still going on by some of us here, and I'll probably get to what we've been trying to do recently later on. So that's my talk. Okay. So the motivation for this scenario is to tackle the problem of dark energy, which you could regard, so there's two ways to say what the dark energy problem is. One is to ask the question, why is the universe currently accelerating? But the other question, the deeper problem, is why is it not accelerating much more than it is? And that is, of course, I'm referring to the greater problem that sits behind it, which is the cosmological constant problem. Now, which I'm sure everybody knows, I'm not gonna say too much about that. Now, I believe in both of these things. We believe that the universe is currently made up of 70% dark energy. We, of course, making a fundamental assumption about the validity of general relativity. It's correct, and it seems an incredible extrapolation to believe that general relativity is true from solar system scales all the way out to 3,800 megaparsecs. But there is a basic theoretical reason why we believe, one strong reason why we think that should be true. And that is because general relativity is the unique infrared limit, and so by infrared I just mean large distances, of a theory of a massless spin two particle. In other words, the graviton. That is to say, as soon as I tell you what is the basic ingredient propagating the force of gravity, as soon as I tell you that that's a massless particle with spin two, and that interacts with matter through its stress energy, so roughly speaking, it's going to box H. Goes like Newton constant times T mu. As soon as I tell you that, just at linearized level, there is a unique nonlinear realization of that in the IR. Not in the UV, can look very different in the UV, but in the IR limit, which is relevant for the cosmological constant and dark energy, because that's the most sort of long wavelength thing we can see today. We're looking at physics at the horizon scale.
So can I ask, does this require a certain covariance, or is that something to do with
it? No, that's the beauty of it. You see, so when you write down, to write down a consistent theory of massless spin two particle, it turns out it has to have a linear gauge invariance, which is it's just the linearized version.
Okay.
That is necessary. Why is that necessary? Because H mu nu carries 10 components, but you know there's only 2 physical degrees of freedom. So you need to get rid, somehow you need to get rid of 8 of them. And the way you do that is you introduce 4 gauge degrees of freedom, so that 4 of them go away by fixing a gauge, and the other 4 go away by there being constraints associated with those gauge degrees of freedom. That's how you get
it. The answer is yes, you require covariance.
No, this is just linearized.
It's a linear
this. And then the argument goes that there's a unique nonlinear realization of that. Okay, that doesn't have Gauss and all sorts of other things. So that, this is a remarkably strong statement, and the strongest version of this statement was discussed by Weinberg, who discussed this really at the quantum level, and showed that if you require an S matrix, which is Lorentz invariant, for graviton scattering, then you basically uniquely led to a theory which satisfies the equivalence principle and looks like general relativity in the infrared. Now, so the same theorem, as I said, also automatically implies the equivalence principle in the sense that electrons and protons have to couple the same way to the graviton. So you have the same Newton constant for every particle. Everything couples in precisely the same way. Similarly, that automatically follows just as soon as I say this and require Lorentz invariants. And the equivalence principle is the killer when it comes to the cosmological constant problem, because it means that not only does everything couple, you know, electrons and protons couple in the same way, it means that you couple equally to the classical part of the stress energy and the quantum part of the stress energy. That means there's no, sometimes people say, well, maybe the cosmological constant is the vacuum energy, or maybe it's not. You can't say that it's not. It has to be in there. It has to be included if you believe the equivalence principle. And that leads to the cosmological constant problem, of which very little progress in tackling has been solved. So now the idea of cascading gravity is to try something more radical to tackle this problem. And because of the strength of this theorem I basically just told you, it also tells you precisely what you have to do if you want to do something different. If you want to modify gravity in the infrared, you have to break one of these assumptions. So for example, you can break Lorentz invariants if you don't mind giving that up. So one thing you can do is you can imagine that there are other degrees of freedom. For example, scalars, which couple to, say, the trace of the stress energy. And those theories, the nonlinear realization of those, of course, are scalar tensor theories, like Brown-Stickey, or F of R, which people have considered a lot in recent years as candidate models of a dynamical dark energy. If you believe dark energy is dynamical, you almost always end up having to do something like this. But these theories, when you have extra degrees of freedom, don't help in any way with the cosmological constant problem. In fact, they make it worse, because they typically mean that instead of a large constant, you have a large contribution in the potential for this scalar field. And you have to introduce extra fine tunings because you need the mass of these fields to be ridiculously light. And so, in fact, you typically double the amount of problems. So it requires something a bit more radical to say something new about this. And the radical thing I'm going to take, that we're implicitly taking in these class of ideas, is that the mass of the graviton is not zero. It may be very small. So these ideas are often called massive gravity. Now, why would I do that? Why is that going to help in any way with regards to the cosmological constant problem? So for one thing, you know, if you have a massless particle, its Newtonian potential will go like 1 over r. But if you have a massive one, it goes like a Yukawa potential. And that means for scales r much bigger than 1 over m, you essentially cut off the force of gravity. Not precisely, but it's much, much weaker in the infrared. Remember that the cosmological constant is the most infrared thing you can write down. It's the most relevant operator in the action. Because it's constant, it's the most long wavelength thing you can possibly think about. So changing your theory in such a way that you cut off the force of gravity in the infrared could possibly allow you to have some kind of mechanism whereby maybe you can have lambda as large as you expect. So whatever value you want, say PV to the 4, Planck mass to the 4, Susie to the 4, whatever large value you typically expect for lambda based on particle physics. But maybe we don't couple to lambda in the way we thought. Maybe effectively we break the equivalence principle. And to see, in fact, there's a nice argument which I think is in Justin's paper that on degravitation, that a massive graviton could potentially achieve this. And the reasoning is, so we know, so how do we describe a massive graviton? So at linearized order, we just take delta g mu nu, which describes the kinetic term, and we want to add a mass. And the mass comes in like this. And the mass has a particularly funny combination, which is necessary to make sure you consistently project out down to the 2 degrees of freedom. But this thing, this action, the equation of motion is what follows from the Fields-Pauli action, where you would describe that. You take the quadratic piece in the Einstein action, just as normal, and you add a mass term, which goes like this. Okay, so that's the Fields-Pauli action that will give this equation of motion when you couple to the stress energy. Now, what adding, so a conventional constant, of course, is just a term on the right-hand side in the linearized theory, which is proportional to the Minkowski metric. And what adding this term has a profound change on the nature of solutions of this theory, because without that term, you know that if you have a cosmodule constant, you have to have curvature. And there's the problem, because we know that the natural value of cosmodule constants is very large, so we naturally get the value of the curvature that's far larger than the current curvature in the universe. In the linearized theory, you see that you get a solution for h mu nu that goes like lambda x nu over m Planck squared. And this is basically just the linearization of the Sitter space, the Sitter space time. So that's what you would get if you sat at some point in the Sitter space and use a Gaussian normal coordinates. Well, locally your value of the Christoffel connection is zero, then the metric in the Sitter space would look like this at leading order. Okay, so that's the standard story. Adding the cosmological constant gives you something like the Sitter. When you add a mass, though, you finally change this, because now I can have a solution in which the curvature is zero, and I support that tension just with a constant value of the metric. So basically, h mu nu goes like minus 4/3 lambda over m Planck squared, eta mu nu. Have I got the m squared, m Planck squared over m squared? Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, over m squared, m Planck squared, that's right. And if you have a linearized metric that's proportional to the Minkowski metric, then this is nothing but a coordinate transformation away from Minkowski space, because the full metric will look like eta mu nu plus h mu nu, which is now proportional to eta mu nu. And so this thing is still Minkowski space, because I can rescale the coordinates and take this factor out. Now, this is only a statement at the linearized level, but nevertheless, you can feel the cosmological constant at the linearized level, because the equivalence principle tells you that locally, I can always think I'm in Minkowski space, and then perturbations nearby me are very small. So for here, you're seeing that's how you see the Sitter. But in this theory, if the same argument goes through, then you see that you can still support this large tension, and yet you can have a solution which is Minkowski space. And so I think that's the most interesting reason to think about these theories of massive gravity. You can have a situation where the real value of lambda could be very large, but you don't feel it directly in the curvature.
Is there a nonlinear version that's known?
Okay. So So that's what I'm going to describe. But let me get to the chain of reasoning that gets us. I liked it when there was a clock up there. I don't like this thing.
You can look at me.
Okay, so how do you describe a theory of massive gravity? Well, it turns out if you just try and give the graviton a fixed mass, and that's all you deal with, you run into problems. But we could have sort of imagined that maybe the graviton didn't have a fixed mass, but was like a resonance, so that we had some distribution of gravitons of mass m, and then the Newtonian potential would be obtained by integrating the Yukawa potential over each one. In the relativistic context, how would we describe that?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I get it. So this is, what is this, rho? This is.
So rho is like a distribution, it's like a spectral density. So it's saying that we don't have, when you have a resonance, it means you don't have a precise state, right? You have something that looks like it, but it's really got some distribution to it.
So this is just a way of locking up a resonance.
Exactly.
For your purposes.
But there's a case where this arises very familiarly, and that's when you have extra dimensions. And the reason is, as soon as you have extra dimensions, you have Kaluza-Klein modes. So even in your standard Kaluza-Klein on an S1 case, you know that if you have sort of, say, one compact extra dimension, however many, it doesn't really matter, and you imagine yourself living on a brain in that setup and coupling and having some stress energy there, then the interaction energy, determine the interaction, will go like H mu nu T mu nu, 3x dt. So this is just the analog of the Newtonian potential times the energy density that we're given the interaction energy, and that's determining the action. When you work this out, it basically goes, we're switching to momentum space. T mu of k star T mu nu of k minus a half e to mu nu t from any massless contribution. And so that's just all I'm putting in here is that the fact that when you've got two sources of stress energy, to calculate the interaction energy between them, then you just simply put the Feynman propagator or the retarded propagator, depending on whether you're doing a sort of quantum or classical calculation, between those two sources. And then this thing describes the contribution in the action, or if you differentiate in time, it's the energy density. That's what you would have for standard massless case. So that's consistent with the fact that 1 over r is coming from the Fourier transform of 1 over k squared, just over the spatial directions. When you have massive particles, massive gravitons, then this formula gets changed as follows. Okay, the only two changes are you put in the propagator for a massive particle here, and you also get this factor of third here, which is a reflection of the fact that a massless particle is propagated by 2 degrees of freedom, but a massive spin 2 particle has 5 degrees of freedom. However, this thing we get all the time. Every time we write down some kind of brain world scenario, you have these massive Kaluza-Klein modes, and that's what these contributions are. So they're the Kaluza-Klein contributions between these two sources, as well as a massless graviton. You have massive ones between as well. Now, so for example, you get this in Randall syndrome as well, where the first term you'd sometimes call the localized zero mode, which you get from the warp factor in the extra dimensions, allows you to localize a 4-dimensional mode on the brain. However, if we want a genuinely massive theory of gravity, if as long as this term is here, this one will always dominate in the infrared, because it's the most massless thing, and the most massless particle is always going to dominate the force in the infrared. So if you want to construct a theory in which the graviton is effectively massive, I'm sorry about this, I should have put in general there's some distribution of Kaluza Klein modes. So rho of n there, that spectral density, is the distribution of Kaluza Klein modes, which might be discrete or continuous, depending on whether your extra dimension is finite or infinite. If you want a genuinely massive theory of gravity, you need to project out this piece, because otherwise that one will dominate, and gravity in the far infrared will always look four-dimensional, and then you'll know you'll be back where you started with the cosmological constant problem. So the idea is how do we do that? Well, it's actually very simple, because normally we spend all our time trying to see where this comes from. So for example, when we have Randall syndrome, the reason we put that warp factor in, we have an infinite extra dimension. Why do we put the warp factor in? It's to localize, to find some four-dimensional mode, which is localized on the brain. Okay. But now let's give that up. We don't want that anymore. Well, that's easy to do. We take a three brain. We take Randall syndrome in five dimensions. And we just get rid of the warping. So this is infinite. So you have one infinite extra dimension. You no longer have a four-dimensional graviton, because the wave function for the zero mode is no longer normalized, because it's infinite. Okay? So that's simply how you project out the massless mode. You just deal with an infinite extra dimension. Now, if that's all we did, we would never recover four-dimensional gravity anywhere, because the Newtonian potential would always go like 1 over r squared, which is what you expect if you really lived in five dimensions, or had four large spatial dimensions. So, in other words, if you look at the spectral density associated with this setup, it won't really be localized anywhere. It'll be very, very broad. And I'm not quite sure how it looks, but it'll be very broad. What we really want is something that looks more like a resonance, which is peaked at some particular value of mass that I will just call the mass of the graviton. And the way to do that was realized in the context of the DGP model, was to take this setup where you have gravity propagating in five dimensions and you're living on a brain in four dimensions, which would just give you this Newtonian potential, which would clearly be wrong, but add to it an extra kinetic term for the graviton. And this turns out to be all you need to do to create this resonance-like structure where the distribution of Kaluza-Klein modes is peaked around some fixed mass. And the mass that it's peaked at turns out to be the ratio of the five-dimensional Planck mass cubed divided by the four-dimensional Planck mass squared. And intuitively, what's going on is that now, if you look at the Newtonian potential, which would be given by this integral of the spectral representation times the Yukawa potential, then what happens is at small distances, this term will always dominate over that term, and so we can treat that as a small perturbation, and then gravity just looks four-dimensional. So the Newtonian potential will go like 1 over r at small distances. But at large distances, if you look at very long wavelength things, they're going to know about this infinite extra dimension. They're going to feel that. So then the Newtonian potential will go like 1 over r squared at large distances. And that was basically in what's called the non-self-accelerating branch of the DGP model. And it is an explicit example of a theory of massive gravity, from which you get the graviton mass as a resonance. So you might ask, does this model exhibit the kind of features that we were claiming that a massive theory of gravity would? In particular, if I put an arbitrary large tension into this model, can I get flat space as a solution? And the answer is certainly no.
That doesn't really make sense. I mean, why does it go to 1 over r squared if its peak that's up there, showing it's a new power potential at large distance? If rho of m is a delta function.
Yeah, so it's because this thing is not as peaked as my picture. it only falls up as a power, as a square root of a power.
Dominated by the high.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a fault.
Okay.
That's a fault in my picture.
That's right.
Yeah, I think it falls off, the spectral density only falls off as a square root of m or something like that. So it's
actually 1 over m. That's,
yeah, I can't remember. Yeah,
depends how you know. Structurally, 1 over m is dominating because it's small masses that dominate at large r. So it's not so much the high mass tail, it's the large.
Sorry, you're right. Yeah, you're right. Okay.
So actually, if you don't have that four dimensional term, how would this look like?
I don't know what kind.
It's going to be a power level. I just want to say it goes to.
Yeah, well, it's the inverse Laplace transform of 1 over r squared. It's not easy to do those in your head.
Just another quick question. I thought there were ghosts in this model.
Good. So if you take this theory fully seriously for all its sets of solutions, then there are solutions of these equations of motion which you expand around and there are ghosts. Now there are also solutions which expand around and there are no ghosts. Okay, so essentially at the classical level, there are two sectors in the theory. There's one which are ghost-free, and one which have ghosts. Now, in our interpretation of these, we're just going to think of this as an effective theory, in which case we're not going to take seriously all the solutions this theory. Mm-hmm. And in particular, what you find is if in order to try and go, you can't classically go between the two branches, but even if you could, if you try and tunnel, say, something like that, you're effectively going to go outside the regime of validity of the effective theory that we're going to deal with. So we're not taking all the solutions of this theory as meaningful. There's no pretense that this is the entire answer.
But you're taking the good ones because you're taking the ones for
that. That's right. So what's going to happen?
It's the self-accelerating that has those ghosts.
It's self-accelerating has the ghosts. Don't care about self-accelerating branch. I think that's being confirmed to be a bad idea.
I thought you fixed it.
No. Anyway, so the motivation here is quite the opposite. So self-acceleration was a way of getting acceleration without tension. And clearly that has to drive up an instability in the system because you're getting something from nothing. That's why you have that ghost. Here we're doing quite the opposite. Well, so the hope is to do quite the opposite, which is where you have a large tension and you don't get acceleration because that would really solve the real problem, the bigger problem of dark energy, which is why we don't accelerate as much as we would expect to.
You get nothing from something.
Exactly. We want to get nothing from something. Which there's a chance of, right? Now, this particular model would not achieve that. And that's because this is just some codimension 1 case, and we know standard law from codimension 1 things. It's very easy to get the Friedman equation on the brain. And it looks something like this, and the point is that equation is local, and therefore, you put in a large tension, and albeit this is a quadratic thing rather than just h squared, but so what? You're still going to get a large h. And so this particular scenario would not achieve what I hoped you would want, which is you can have a large tension, but get but not have a large curve geometry. And the explanation of that is, it turns out, so if you look at the propagator, so if you look at the Fourier transform of this, or the propagator, then, in other words, if you think of phi as the Fourier transform, of the propagator g of k, which normally goes like 1 over k squared. If you compute g of k, it basically looks like k squared plus square root of k squared times m. And so you see the weakening of gravity in the infrared is represented by this thing. So in the short distances, k is large. This will dominate. Gravity looks four-dimensional. At large distances, k is small. This piece will dominate. And the square root of k squared here is exactly what will get the Fourier transform to look like 1 over r squared. So that question I can answer. You can do Fourier transforms. But it turns out that, as shown in Justin's paper on the degravitation idea, this weakening of gravity is not sufficient to provide the desired filtering mechanism whereby you could exhibit a solution. Fix up my dimensions here. In which you could have a large tension, but have Minkowski space as a solution. It turns out that you need sort of the types of propagators you get in these modified gravity theories. I've just parameterized by this. You need this parameter alpha to be less than half to achieve this, and the DGP model is exactly the case of a half. Putting that in terms of the Friedman equation, the DGP case gives you a local Friedman equation. But if we were to achieve this mechanism, we would expect that the Friedman equation would be non-local, effectively. Because as long as it's local, we're going to be screwed by the fact that if we put large thing on the right-hand side, we're going to get a large thing on the left-hand side somewhere. Something has to make that. Okay, so the question you want to ask then, so if we believe this argument from the linearized theory, how do we get alpha to be less than a half? And now it's just a question of Fourier transforms again. Basically, the idea is you go to extra dimensions. So add more than one, because we know, say, for example, if you're in six dimensions, the Newtonian potential goes 1 over r cubed. If you're in 7, 1 over r to the 4. If you Fourier transform that, or inverse Fourier transform that, and find what propagator you would have to have, it turns out that in all higher dimensions, higher than 5, alpha is effectively 0. So in the case of 6, it turns out that this really goes like a log, and then in higher dimensions, it's effectively 0. So although we don't have a realization of the case between alpha 0 and a half, we do know that if we just basically take the DGP model and stick it up a dimension, then we're going to get alpha is 0, in which we can achieve this mechanism. And so the cascading gravity idea, the reason it's called cascading, you can do it in any dimension, and you basically copy what you did in DGP. So you start in whatever dimensions you want, say 6, and then you have a codimension 1 brain on that, and you have a kinetic term for the graviton in 6 dimensions, and you put a kinetic term for the graviton in 5 dimensions, and then you have a brain living on that, and you have a kinetic term in 4 dimensions. And you can do that and so on and so on and so on. And that's the cascading setup. And just the act of doing that is enough to switch the propagator around to this sufficiently soft form that we could potentially achieve this idea of degravitation where we can have a large tension but not have a large curvature associated with it. Okay, how long have I got? Sort of 5 minutes. 5 minutes. Okay, so. Okay, so what does the... Now, so it turns out whenever you try and write these theories down, these modified theories down, you are plagued by... You always get plagued by ghosts. You have to make sure that you don't get ghosts in the theory. Now, if you just do what I said, So you, if you don't put any tension on any of these brains, and you just have a six-dimensional theory with R6 and R5 and R4, you will get a ghost. And the reason for that ghost surprised us at first. But in fact, there is an obvious, I think there is an obvious explanation of why you get a ghost. And that is because of something that's sometimes called the conformal factor problem, or in the present case, the normal reason it's called a problem is for different reasons, but the conformal factor problem is the following. So if you take a metric, which is conformal to another metric, and you compute the contribution in the action from the conformal factor, and you do a bit of integration by parts, you find that the kinetic term for the conformal factor here, the kinetic term for the conformal factor, has the wrong sign. It's a ghost. So in my conventions, a right sign kinetic term would have a minus here. So having a plus is a wrong sign kinetic term. Now, in ordinary gravity, when we just do four-dimensional gravity, that's not physically a problem. And you can see that in different ways, but basically, I could always choose a gauge in which the conformal factor is one. And so you see that really it's just that particular feature is a gauge artifact. But what happens when you set up this scenario, the conformal factor on the four-dimensional conformal factor is the thing that's going to couple to the trace of the stress energy. Because you would have had, if you think about it in the linearized theory, in the four-dimensional action, you have some coupling of the stress energy to the graviton. So in the linearized theory, the conformal factor will just look like a mode for the graviton, which is proportional to the Minkowski metric. And so that will provide a sort of classic Brownsticky-like scalar coupling pi to the trace of the stress energy. But if you calculate, so if you add this four-dimensional kinetic term for this field, and you calculate this, precisely because of this conformal factor problem, the kinetic term for that comes out with the wrong sign. And so, in particular, if you look at the scalar sector of the theory, what happens is that the full action has, you have a six-dimensional kinetic term, which has the right sign, which goes like m6 cubed, plus a five-dimensional kinetic term, which has the right sign, which goes like m5 cubed, but the four-dimensional term coming from R4 has the wrong sign, because of that conformal factor problem. So this setup by itself would have a ghost in the scalar sector. The tensors are okay because, for tensor modes, if you look at transverse traceless tensors, then R is always just exactly, you know, what you want it to be. Standard positive. So if you look at root minus GR, you always get positive kinetic term for the tensor modes. So the ghosts always arise in the scalar set. This argument basically is going to apply for high codimensions as well, because you're always going to have the scalar mode which couples to the trace of the stress energy, which is going to look like a ghost. The DGP case, where you only had an R5 and R4, was an exception, because in that case, the transverse traceless modes, transverse traceless tensor has five components, and therefore already accounts all the 5 degrees of freedom of a massive graviton. So that tells you that the scalar mode cannot be physically propagated. And so, in a sense, it's an accident that the ordinary branch, the non-self-Victorian branch of the DGP model, does not have a ghost. Okay, but it turns out that, surprisingly, it's easy enough to resolve this, Well, hard to calculate it, so it works, but it's easy enough to resolve it. By adding attention on that, what is here a four-dimensional two brain, in other words, on the 3+1-dimensional brain that we live on. And in fact, that's okay, because the whole setup is to describe how we could have a large tension but not feel feel the effects of that. And for sort of subtle technical reasons, when you add the tension on the brain, it ends up generating an additional kinetic term for that scalar mode, which has the right sign. And so if the tension is bigger than some value, which turns out to be... That's an unhappy face. The tension turns out to be bigger than some value, which turns out to be the four-dimensional Planck mass squared times m6 squared, where m6 is m6 cubed over m5 cubed. So this is the ratio of the six-dimensional, Planck mass to the four over the five-dimensional Planck mass cubed. If the tension is bigger than that, we can remove the curve. So what does the solution look like with that tension? It turns out it has the promised properties that you can have a tension, and yet you have no curvature. And the way it achieves that is that the six-dimensional solution, what happens is that 4+1-dimensional brain ends up looking like this. So it has a kink. So the bulk looks like Minkowski space. So you take six-dimensional Minkowski space, and then you draw a four-dimensional one brain in it that has a kink precisely where the four-dimensional two brain, where we live, I'm at here. What's happening is that the tension on this brain is creating that kink. Although the local curvature on this metric is all completely flat, there is extrinsic curvature. And by the Israel matching condition, it's the extrinsic curvature which is supporting the tension. And this is very much like, in fact, it really is the same as when you have a tension in, like a cosmic string, any codimension two objects, when you have a tension, it creates a deficit angle in the geometry. So it doesn't locally curve the geometry. So if we just had a cosmic string, for example, with some tension, it's the same story. All that happens is that as you go around the string, the angles don't quite add up to 2 pi, but locally you don't curve anything. So this explicit solution seems to achieve precisely what we want. And I was going to say something else, but I've forgotten now.
What was the tension on the five-dimensional brain? Was that?
So that would put, we're putting to zero in the solution. You don't need tension there. So you just have. So we're living here, and so we're sort of concerned only about the tension that's coming from the matter, which is the quantum contributions to the matter, which is set down here.
So you have an example for 6 to 5 to 4.
That's
and
right.
The 6 is special because of the geometry.
It is, exactly. So
what happens if you go
also? No idea. Absolutely no idea. I mean, it's just horrendous to even think about it. So that would be my worry. So, you know, I mean, I could have done that with a normal cosmic string. So why am I not solve things there? So people tried this idea, a few years ago, as a sort of self-tuning idea where you have a codimension two brain. And it doesn't work because basically you're never going to get a situation. Either you end up having some kind of singularity in the bulk, or you don't have a situation where you recover four-dimensional gravity. Here, at least, we've in a sense realized that idea where we really can have a situation where gravity does look four-dimensional in the UV, and so you can recover standard gravity. And yet we somehow managed to hide away the tension inside the extra dimension. So it does realize that. However, I would worry that it's not using the promised mechanism, which is the degravitation idea, but it's using this special feature of third dimension two things. So it would be very nice to have an explicit construction in the higher codimension case that would achieve that. But it's horrendous.
Can you embed the cosmology with very scalar factor? You say not just lambda.
So you mean have cosmology here?
Yeah.
So the problem is we tried that again. It's quite difficult because so in the codimension one case, if you're just doing Randall syndrome or something similar like that, in general you would expect the bulk to depend on t and y, and here to depend on t. But you have a Birkhoff theorem, right? And that allows you to get around that. You know the bulk is static. You can just think about the frame moving and that, and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. Makes it very simple. Mm-hmm. So you might guess here, maybe here in general, you would expect this to depend on t, this to depend on t and y, and this to depend on t, y, and z. Now, but you might go, maybe you're lucky, and there's some equivalent Birkhoff theorem where this only depends on two directions, and you can think about the brain moving in that. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to work out, because we know the most general solutions here, which only depend on two directions, and we couldn't seem to get it to work. But that would be like the most important thing to do in some sense, to see. It's not enough just to get a solution, but you need to see that you can have a meaningful cosmology that looks normal, and yet you can still hide away this large tension. So I'm sorry, I've been like 15 minutes over.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah.
We have lots of charity questions, Jan.
Mm-hmm. So you just said if you put five dimensional brain, this tension now is zero?
Yeah.
So just a little bit. Curious, what is the physical, you know, why is there a brain at all? Because it doesn't even have a tension.
So it still has, so you still oppose the Z2 symmetry around that. So it has topological effects, so it affects the perturbations. You're also adding a kinetic term to localize.
Yeah, but is that brain flat?
Yeah, but for perturbations, it comes in. Yeah.
So essentially, it's some sort of defect of the space. Of space.
Right, right. Yeah, you can just think of that as your standard sort of Z2 brain, and then we've got a domain wall living on that. Practice.
Okay, it's a side bit.